I think we should start again. The presenters are ready. Those who still have their cups, they must come in with their cups and their saucers. We are starting all over again. Patke, over to you. It's your second presentation.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chair and Honorable Members. To clarify, Patke is a practice, a private pathology practice in the country, who is also a member of the Laboratory Medicine Group, and I perform a role on the Laboratory Medicine Group in assisting them with in the working group with health policy, and hence my participation in both presentations. The CEO of Pathcare is currently in India, otherwise he would have been here. We were invited 2 days ago, so we couldn't get him back fast enough. And the head of quality division is also in Nigeria performing assessments and audits for the Nigerian parts of our laboratory. So just to introduce ourselves, I am Kieran Begg, Chief Operations Officer for Pathcare, and also the Head of Strategy and Policy for Pathcare. My background is not in pathology, it's in fact in public health medicine, so I'm a specialist in public health medicine, hence the policy-related interest. Beside me is Dr. Eunice Essek, who is a chemical pathologist, and both of us have worked in the public and the private sector, so whilst we are representing Pathcare today, we also come with the perspective of having worked both in the public and the private sectors as clinicians and specialists. And he in particular has assisted in his capacity in NHLS in accreditation and quality management processes, so he sits here assisting us in that. Thank you for the opportunity to present. I won't repeat any points that we've already made in previous presentations, so I will simply give you additional information that we've had. So it should be a relatively quick presentation. So just to advise that whilst private sector healthcare is often perceived to be relatively young in the country, in fact, Pathcare was started in 1922. So it has a relatively long history and has a number of staff, a number of pathologists, 60 laboratories, and tests over 3.8 million patients annually. And our core function and responsibility we see is towards the patient, whilst we don't necessarily interact always directly with the patient, but through their clinician who requests the tests on our behalf. We have a wide geographic footprint across South Africa, but also operate in Namibia, Nigeria, Kenya, Lesotho, and also have interest in Ghana and Dubai. So we have experience in certainly in quality and aspects outside of South African borders as well. Pathcare, we want to just reiterate that we are completely committed to quality and therefore very encouraged by the publication of the amendment in terms of the Office of Health Standards compliance. And our commitment to quality healthcare goes back a very long way in being the first laboratory in South Africa to be accredited. And to date, we have 58 laboratories accredited. We also were the first to be accredited in Namibia, and in East Africa in Kenya, and in West Africa in Nigeria, according to the ISO standards. So just to simply illustrate that we've had that commitment and experience and expertise for a significant period of time. The quality division is a whole division that reports directly to the CEO. We have close to 3,600 standard operating procedures. Some of those are referred to in the, so these would be standard guidelines or procedures or standards that are referred to in the Office of Health Standards Compliance. Seven of our members are in fact qualified SANA assessors, and our head of quality, who is unable to be here today, has international experience and expertise assisting with the Clinical and Laboratory Standards Institute, ISO and SABS. So I think we've already covered the fact that laboratories are by definition included under the requirements of the Office for Health Standards Compliance due to the definition of a health establishment. What we really want to illustrate now is around some of the aspects where we believe that the intent around the Office for Health Standards Compliance is predominantly around clinical facilities and where some of the challenges would occur for laboratories. So the laboratory testing process, much of the Office for Health Standards Compliance core standards and the intent behind it would have happened even before step one of the steps that I'm going to illustrate now, which is at the point at which doctor requests the test. The specimen is then collected from the patient, it's transported, it's received and data captured, it's processed, analyzed, the result is reviewed and interpreted, it's reported and distributed, and then enabling the doctor to diagnose and treat the patient. What we're wanting to illustrate is that within a laboratory environment, there's continual quality improvement. At every single one of these steps, there are multiple standard operating procedures on which staff are trained, methods are validated, instruments are calibrated, and frequent internal audit followed by external audit at a later stage. So this is already happening in a very robust and rigorous way in a laboratory setting. This serves to illustrate that it's not just in terms of the clinical experience, but also related to the quality system essentials, relate to every step, but relate to documents and records, information management, our equipment, our processes to make them efficient, our personnel, and across all disciplines of pathology. So when we look at the certification as proposed under the office, and the existing accreditation process, and I'm specifically referring here to medical laboratories because that's who we represent today, I'll illustrate some of the applicability and duplication issues that we raised in general earlier, and we'll have look at it a little bit more specifically in this particular presentation. So the laboratory accreditation process under the auspices of SANUS, which essentially audits us against the ISO guidelines, one first has to have one's own quality plan and implementation mechanisms. So drafting policies and standard operating procedures in terms of the ISO guidelines, training those staff, and then staff are actually agreeing to comply with those by signing that they are committing to compete and in fact to act in those in that way. There's then regular audits performed in terms of, do we do what we say we're going to do? So are we walking the talk of what we intend to do? And then we're followed by external audits where this external statutory body comes in and assesses us against these standards and then identifies what we call non-conformities or non-compliance and documents those. And there's a very clear, strict procedure with strict timelines around how one needs to then correct those with corrective actions and then need to fix those. And then obviously an accreditation certificate is issued and there's a redress mechanism if there is any disagreement. I think that the question earlier about the regulations versus the legislation is that the regulations would in all likelihood illustrate the procedure a bit better, and we'd certainly want to encourage the procedure is as explicit as other standards and accreditation processes in terms of timelines, deadlines, exactly what standards, etc. But from what we can interpret out of the existing draft amendment bill before us is that there would also be four processes through setting of standards, inspection, certification, and enforcement. But there are one or two concerns that would either need to be clarified in the draft act now or in regulations to come. And those would be around some of the inspection-related issues, the health officers and inspectors. It's not completely clear what the difference is between them, what either would be doing, what their qualifications, functions, and roles would be to ensure that they don't step on each other's toes, never mind on other inspectors and assessors' toes of coming from other alternatives. So we're sure that that's coming, but that would need to be important. And then there's a whole range of things that they're enabled to do to question, to take samples. And I think perhaps on the taking samples, that would probably need to be clarified under regulations as to how that would take place. For instance, in our environment, that sample represents the patient, the specimen represents the patient, and if a health officer or an inspector is entitled to take that sample, what the medical legal implications would be of such things. So we're just alerting to the fact that those are things that we would hope to see answered either in the bill or in regulations to be published thereafter. In the certification-related issues, there's the health officers or inspectors can then issue compliance notices or a non-compliance notice if you're not compliant. And it states that they must then issue what the details are of that non-compliance, what the action must be taken, and then the penalties that are applicable. But we're hoping then that would be very detailed in procedures related to regulations, because it does appear that there would be almost some discretion allowed with the health officers or the inspectors. And clearly, I'm sure that's not the intention of what's been published. The office would then issue the compliance certificate, and fines could be imposed if there was no compliance certificate or there wasn't any corrective action, and could also be referred for prosecution. So these are significant penalties, and so one would need to make sure that the procedure is very clear, very specific, leaves no room for doubt, considering that the penalties are very significant. The fine is up to 10 million rand, and clearly prosecution is probably even more worrying for anybody in those positions. So that's related to the accreditation and certification process. And I'm sure you can see that we're reiterating the same point, that if there is already an accreditation process in place that is robust and rigorous, that perhaps we don't need to duplicate it in those particular cases. Now we're going to illustrate one or two examples around the core standards. Now the core standards are not in the draft amendment, but it refers to the core standards, and they have been published as a framework for the assessment of health establishments. So these are, and remember that health establishments have been defined under the Act as including laboratories. So we have clearly looked through them to see where some of the challenges might be. So when we look at an example, and not to intend that you can read the standard at all, but we're just simply illustrating the points, that the standard 2.3 is around diagnostic laboratory services, which clearly applies directly to us. But in fact, the intent behind that standard is around hospitals and clinics having access to laboratory services, not in fact to evaluate and assess those diagnostic laboratory services. But one of the cause which is listed there at the bottom is the quality of the results. So the standard is that the quality of the results is perceived by clinicians and management to be acceptable. And we would be quite concerned if perceptions of quality would determine whether one were compliant or not around the correctness or reliability of a test. And we're sure that's not the intention, but that is the wording as it stands now. Whereas we'd acknowledge that we'd suggest that if there is an accredited competence demonstrated of a laboratory to perform the designated tests through independently reviewed scientific evidence, that should be what the standard should entail. Another example is around the delivery of an appropriate package of services. I must just at this point illustrate that we found it very difficult to find how laboratories would be assessed by these standards. But yet we're defined as a health establishment. So we've tried to find things that might apply, but we did find it quite difficult. So we used the appropriate package of services, and that includes infrastructure, staffing, and equipment. But it was very difficult to try and find that, and the standards are obviously a lot better than is in existence currently for particularly public sector facilities, clinics, and hospitals. But if one compares it, for instance, if we were to be assessed as a laboratory, to the ISO standard, which is an equivalent standard, but this is just a subcomponent of that standard, which is clause 5.4, which is around pre-examination procedures. And part of that pre-examination is venipuncture. And just to demedicalize the term, that's basically the taking of blood with a needle, putting it into a vein, and taking the blood specimen. So that particular standard for ISO, as you can see, is a fairly lengthy, detailed document. I don't intend for you to read it, but it's just purely for illustrative purposes. And then when one takes the organizations who have to comply with those standards, they have to then compile their SOPs. Now, our nursing SOPs alone, now remember, we're not primarily a nursing organization, so our nursing SOPs are purely around the venipuncture and taking of specimens component. And our nursing SOPs alone number those three pages. The SOP for venipuncture alone, so that's purely the taking of blood to make sure that we do it correctly, don't harm the patient, take the specimen in the correct way so that when it gets to the lab it will be valid and reliable, and that we won't end up with an incorrect potassium result because the tourniquet was too tight, or it was taken in the wrong tube, all those kinds of things, is that that particular SOP, just the technique for that, is 9 pages long. So I think what we're trying to illustrate is that the ISO standards and the SOPs that accompany those are very rigorous and robust, And so we'd like to recommend that in the cases where those kind of robust international standards exist, that exemption be allowed. So we're still liable, but only provided that you can prove your accreditation under these kind of strict and rigorous guidelines. The last example, and then we'll be very close to finishing, is the appropriate use of technology under core standard 2.5. Now, clearly, laboratories are predominantly around technology. So the standard entails around the risk policy around using medical devices and also around what equipment should be available. But, of course, the what equipment should be available is only defined in terms of clinical facilities, so clinics and hospitals, healthcare centers, but it doesn't define, for instance, what should be available in a laboratory. And we're quite happy that it doesn't, but we wouldn't then have to be, we shouldn't then have to be accountable to this. Whereas when you look at the ISO standard, which is clause 5.3 on laboratory equipment, you can also see it's a fairly extensive and lengthy document. And the SOP for PathCare alone on how to validate an instrument before it's even placed in the laboratory, in other words, to make sure that it will generate a correct and valid and reliable result of any specimen that's passed through it, is a 30-page document. So that what we really wanted to emphasize in this particular presentation is the aspect around accreditation and in certification, where there is already accreditation that that fulfills the purposes and the intent behind certification that exemption be allowed. And secondly, the core standards must obviously be applicable to the health establishment for which it is designed. And the core standards that are currently here are, and I've got numerous examples here, I'm not going to go into them, but numerous examples where the names are actually mentioned of clinics, hospitals, hospital managers, clinic facility managers, district managers, which is perfectly appropriate for that setting, which currently don't have guidelines for them. But the definition is that it's a framework for the assessment of health establishments, so these would, by definition, apply to us unless we were exempt. I'm not going to go again into the conflict with other quality standards because I think that's already been covered today. Likewise, the objectives and functioning, which what we'd like to say is we would like to see it even more robust. We would like the office to have strong, it must be very clear that they have strong powers. So that's the reasoning for this, is purely to strengthen the definitions and the role and function so that the office has its due authority. So in conclusion, a very whistle-stop tour through some specific examples, but just to reiterate, that PathCare wholeheartedly supports the establishment of the office in order to address quality of care in health services in general, and particularly in the component of health services that haven't yet been covered by any other form of accreditation or health standards and are held accountable to any form of health standards. But what we would say is that where it relates to laboratory services, that we propose that we don't duplicate efforts and resources, and that where there is proof of accreditation that we allow for exemption, that the conflict with other legislation, I think we've mentioned a couple of times this morning, that if that could just be explicit so that we know which is reign supreme. The concern, obviously the core standards are not part of the bill, we know that, but they are made reference to in the bill, so it does tie up with that, and currently they're not applicable to health establishments outside of hospitals and clinics because that's their intent, and we're very happy that that's the intent, but then it may need to specify that it's health establishments, a sub-definition of health establishments. And that the rigor and stringency, that where there are standards that already exist that are more robust, more rigorous, internationally comparable, that that those can be deferred to in that particular instance. And I think I've already covered my recommendations and the conclusions. So the insurer allow an exemption, provided the health establishment is already accredited by a recognized statutory or legislated institution, to clarify overlaps and potential for conflict, and to utilize... I think the other component that perhaps the previous presenter mentioned is that what we're trying to illustrate is that there's lots of experience in quality management systems in laboratories, and we may be able to provide assistance in terms of some of that experience, and I think they called it expert committees. I think what we're saying is that we're very happy to help and learn through some of the lessons that have been learned over the last 10 years, and provide some of that assistance to the department and any other institution that might like it. So thank you very much for the time and opportunity. We really do appreciate it, and thank you.
Thank you very much, members. That's it. Questions of clarity. I see Honorable Ngobo. Is that the only one? Okay, Honorable Ngobo.
Chairperson, I must thank the presenter, but I'm getting more confused as we get these inputs. Number one, up to so far, we're getting inputs from the laboratories. Fine, that's okay, because they long have had standards. But when it comes to our case, we are looking, maybe it's the word establishment that is problematic, that needs to be defined. Because as we speak today, the health care of South Africa is not good. It's really not good. You go to a hospital, to a clinic, to a whatever, it's not good. So that's the area that this bill is looking into in order to change the health of this country. In then, when the establishments have been redefined, what the Act tries to say. Because what is happening in our public hospitals, clinics, and whatever, lacks sparkle. For instance, we've got a problem of the laboratories see numbers, see papers, see forms, see tubes, see blood, whereas in the health setting where there are patients, we see patients who are blinking and walking, who are sick, who come there because they are sick or they have got problems which have to be dealt with. We see public hospitals which are full beyond capacity. We see clinics which are now getting so full that it takes the clinics that were meant for 8 hours end up going longer than 8 hours because there are more people. And of course, the burden of disease. So I think the main intent of this act is to address that. The cleanliness of the hospital, the cleanliness of the people that are dealing with the patients, those are things that we would really like to look at. And to ensure that patients are getting the care they are supposed to get where they are, like the days of Florence Nightingale. Thank you.
Thank you. And so you'll be jotting them down. That was the only hand that I saw. I'm not sure whether there's somebody who wants to add on something or for clarity purposes. Okay, you can go and talk about it.
Thank you very much, Honourable Member. And I think we completely agree with you. So I don't think there's any doubt on our side. And I think particularly for the two of us who happen to be here today have actually worked as clinicians in the public sector. So I think we're very familiar with that. Still do voluntary work in NGO environments. I'm very, very aware of those. I think what we're trying to say, it's exactly what we're trying to say. The intent of the legislation is to fix quality of healthcare. It was consistent in the NHI Green Paper to fix quality of care in public sector institutions, and not to say that the private sector are any special or different, so therefore private sector institutions should be there, but it is around healthcare facilities. It's around clinics, hospitals, and those kinds of aspects. I think for us the concern is that when you look at the definition of a health establishment, it includes laboratories, other therapeutic interventions, and you may want to look at some others. We're not here to present those, but they are preventative and other health services. I think what we're saying is that whilst other provisions of the National Health Act must apply to all health establishments, this particular provision, perhaps we should have a definition that either exempts components of health establishments that are already accredited, or so that we make sure that the intent of this draft legislation is in fact realized. And so that we don't end up having arguments about petty things because we can't get the standards to apply to places that they were never meant to apply to, like laboratories or radiology facilities or other similar kind of entities. So what we completely agree that the intent, as we understand it, was designed for hospitals, clinics, day hospitals, community health centres, those kind of environments, and that we, and we believe that's right, and it must be there. And so we wholeheartedly support that. I think what we're trying to get across is two points. One is that create an exemption clause for those health establishments as defined that are dealt with other ways. But we also believe that we should be held accountable for quality. So we're not saying that we shouldn't be held accountable, but perhaps we must just be held accountable in a slightly different mechanism. And so what we're suggesting is that how we held accountable is to say that we it applies except if you are can prove that you're already accredited through a body that's much more applicable. So that's the main point that we want to make. The second is that we have significant experience and that we're sure that, that some of that experience, whilst it does apply to laboratories, there are some consistent principles around how you draft standards, where drafting standards can make your life a little bit more difficult and have unintended consequences, and how to assess those standards. And so there's some experience around that that I'm sure that we could offer to the department. So I think those were really the two main points that we had. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I think we'll step off this one and then go to another presentation. But thank you very much. In fact, the area that we need to thank you most is the area where you say you are there to help if we need help as a portfolio committee, and we'll probably call on you whenever we want help. I think for us to be able to build this South Africa, we've got to do it together, everybody. So, you thought, okay, come. Sorry, maybe there's still another clarity.
Chairperson, you know, you know my story that I always say I'm neither a doctor nor a nurse. I'm just a patient. So the questions maybe that one might ask might not at least be too relevant, but I really need to ask this question. I want to find out, this body, SANA, who is, you know, because the protection to me around SANA is if they are the main people who can give accreditation to hospitals, give me some tinglings, you know, and I just want to find out what is it that we are scared of to say, if we see like the witness just said that the health in South Africa is in tatters. We are all aware and we all can see that it's happening. But this accreditation body, that is so, you know, protected, defended, and, you know, it must be kept there and not be touched. What is it that is happening? It's irrelevant maybe for this, but I just want to leave this house understanding. And when we say we are a little bit skeptical, the presenters, about what might happen, my way was going to be from my side, if I was from the other side, to say we are asking for the people who are going to draft should include. But if we have all these negative doubts, negative, don't go there, don't come here, I don't know, but it's just a concern. Thank you, Chair.
I think maybe, Dr. Pett, you'll have to come in. But I just want to put my own understanding of this SANAS. I think we are talking about norms and standards. And obviously one will have to look whether are we complying with those norms and standards when the bill has been passed. Now, for you to say this one is right, is doing the right thing, you have to accredit it. Now, what they are saying, if I'm understanding them well, they are saying that, okay, we agree that there should be an Office of Standards. Everybody agrees about that. But what they are saying is that there is a law that was passed by DTI to form an accreditation body, which is SANAS. Now, SANAS is already there, has been accrediting these institutions. All they are saying is that what is going to happen to those accreditations if we've been accredited by SANAS? come in, this institution has been accredited by SANAS, and then the new Office of Standards come in, are they going to say, okay, now that you have been accredited, we won't do the detailed work because you have already been accredited? For me, it's just like if I get my MBCHB, my Bachelor of Medicine in Zimbabwe, if I come to South Africa, would I be accredited on some of the courses that I've done in Zimbabwe when I come to South Africa? Or would I have to start the whole degree again to say, no, in South Africa, we don't recognize the degree of... I think that's the question. Is this the standards that have been accredited by SANAS going to be accredited by this body? Obviously, we don't know, but we're taking your suggestions, and we're going to be looking at all the laws that are coming in and decide which one. That's my understanding, but you can answer.
I think that's exactly that, is that there are a number of accrediting bodies and standards bodies around the country, which I think we illustrated on one of the slides. It just so happens that SANAS is the statutory body designated in South Africa, which, by the way, also accredits throughout Africa. But they are the designated body that is able, that is certified by the international, by ILAC and a few other international organizations, that they are allowed to certify and to accredit laboratories on that particular, on those ISO standards. So they are expert, and those are the particular standards that are applicable. In the same way as Medicines Control Council applies standards to the way that medicines are regulated, et cetera. In the same way that Pharmacy Council would inspect pharmacies and accredit and make sure that they comply with standards. In the same way that Health Professions Council would accredit training facilities for training establishments for health professionals. So I think if there's nothing, it just so happens that SANAS is the statutory body that accredits laboratories against the international standard. I think more than SANAS, actually the importance, perhaps the message today, is that it's the ISO standard. It's the International Standards Organization. It's a robust and rigorous standard that all laboratories worldwide are evaluated against when you want to be accredited. And that this happens across public and private sector in South Africa. It also happens throughout Africa in terms of, and throughout the rest of the world. It just so happens SANAS is the accrediting authority for here. But other bodies would accredit against the same standards, would be certified to accredit against those same standards in other countries. So it's just that's the applicability to laboratories, whereas there are other bodies, other statutory bodies that are applicable to other standards. And what we're saying is that the Office for Health Standards Compliance, the applicability appears, and we think the intention of the applicability is to health facilities, to clinical facilities, to clinics and hospitals, and they're not applicable the way that they're currently designed. And we're not sure that was ever the intention, was to be applicable to laboratories, and we're quite comfortable with that. But unless we address the definition, it's going to have to become applicable. And we think that place is probably a duplicative and a resource draining effect on the office. So it's not to uphold SANAS to be anything particularly special. It's more about the fact that they are just happen to be the body that is statutorily authorized to accredit us against the ISO standard.
Thank you very much. We are looking for ideas. We don't want to do things that we're going to be answering in 20 years down the line. By that time, some of us will be dead. We don't want to come back and be asked and say they made a mistake. We don't want to make mistakes. That's why we want everybody to come with their ideas, so that when we pass the law, it will be a perfect law. Thank you. Thank you very much, Patke. The next group. HASA. I don't want to use acronyms again. I was asked about VVF. VVF is vesico vaginal fistula. But this one, HASA, now is Hospital Association of South Africa. So, you are going to be connecting your computer. Do do you need somebody to? I see the CEO is giving you credit cards. There's a lot of money in the hospital association. Oh, I thought it was the credit card, so that you're giving the PIN number and everything. Connect the computer. Yeah. There's a fundi that knows how to connect the things. Apparently, he's just gone out. Maybe in the meantime we could be entertaining questions if there are. I know there are some people who are not going to be presenting. By the way, on Tuesday, I got a letter in my office as I moved out of the public hearings, which was complaining that they were here and they were not allowed to ask questions. I think you can ask questions if you want to in the meantime. She was furious with me that I didn't allow her to ask her. You can ask a question.
Good day, my name is Damaris Kiewit and I'm from Senqoko, Western Cape, as well as the Cape Metro Health Forum. I think the importance of the community being involved in the process is the fact that there is a National Health Act, and the Act is now being unpacked in different bowls. And our biggest concern is 5 years down the line, the irrelevance of the Act, because it's been unpacked in different sections. Our concern around the ombudsman is that the Western Cape tried exactly the same thing. It hasn't worked because the ombudsman was appointed without terms of reference as well as standard operating procedures of how this ombudsman is going to work. I think the community's frustration and concern, and I witnessed it this morning in the noon, where the community was prepared to burn down the health facility, and no politician were prepared to step into the gap. The people that has been appointed in the Western Cape to serve as ombuds people were nowhere to be found. And I think the challenge that we as communities have is that our concerns are real. And they are relevant. And how do we diffuse the frustrations that is currently happening in our health facilities? If I look at what the National Minister said on Tuesday with regards to the maternal and infant deaths, my concern would be if there's an ombudsman, what difference is it going to make? Are women going to have a different service? And I think for me, the portfolio committee at a national level, we really need to think thoroughly about, if we agree for this bill to be passed, is that what purpose is the ombudsman going to serve? Is it going to be relevant to the needs of the country currently, because the complaint system in the country currently don't work, it's not effective, and the communities at the bottom don't see any difference. So that would be our concerns. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'm hoping that those concerns are going to be jotted down and sent to you. That I would request you to do that. We don't want to respond to them. We are very objective this side. We don't want to take any sides, but all we're interested in people voicing their views. Ours is not to comment at this time, but I'm not sure whether members, if somebody wants to ask clarities about the ombudsman in the Western Cape not doing whatever. But we take your concerns. We're going to, if they can be written down, and then we'll entertain them. Are there any comments from the members? Not for now. Okay. Are we ready? Thank you very much. Thank you very much. That's why we called you. We want all the brains. Okay. If you are ready.
Thank you, Honourable Chair, good day, Honourable Members of the House. My name is Nkaki Matlala. You have hosted me many times, and today you are going to be given a rest from my voice. I'm introducing the CEO of the Hospital Association of South Africa, who will make the presentation. Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Chair, and Honourable Members, for affording us the opportunity and hosting us today. We really appreciate your time and your hospitality. And before I start my presentation, I also would like to acknowledge the effort and time and trouble that has been taken by the top management of the Department of Health, who are sitting on my right side, and I'll jump straight into our presentation. This is a presentation by the Hospital Association of South Africa, and the way that our presentation is structured is along these six bullets. We'll quickly start talking about HASA, who we are, and then we'll state very clearly our position on this bill in an unambiguous manner. And then the next three bullets, number 3, 4, 5, will deal with the substantive issues that we would like to raise. Those would be the concerns around the norms and standards. Then we'll deal with the driving principles for an effective Office of Health Standards Compliance, and that will be followed by our recommended structure and functionaries of that which we deem or which we propose to be an effective Office of Health Standards Compliance. And just to finish off the presentation, we will share with you the international experience, some of the international experience we've looked at, which we draw our inspiration from, and from which our proposal are essentially based, the international experience on which the proposals are based. HASA is an industry association that represents the private hospital industry in South Africa. And currently, we represent over 200 private hospitals that are operating. And this includes 28,000 beds of the approximately 31,000 beds total that are in the country. I think just to make that point more relevant, in terms of health establishments and facilities, we convention is to assess its size by the number of beds, and that amounts to more than 90% of private hospital beds in the country. This is HASA's position on the bill that we are discussing. We are in full support of the objectives of the Office of Health Standards Compliance, which in our own view are to promote patient health and safety. I think this is a point that has been dealt with a lot in terms of what does the bill intend to do. Our view is that it's to promote patient health and safety, and it will be clearer just now what we mean by that. And then the next slide is on substantive issue. We start dealing with some of the concerns. We have the following concerns. They are not problems. They are issues that are not clear in our minds, which I must say up front, we would not like a law that leaves much to guesswork and opinion. We would like things to be stated categorically in law so that there's no confusion, as the chair says, in future where the law was found to be defective and subjected to multiple interpretations and the chaos that may ensue. Firstly, it's on the definition. There is no definition of the terms, norms and standards, even though it's referred to. And then that's the what. Then there's no definition of the process used to arrive at those norms and standards, or process that will be used. That is the how. So that relates to definition. The second part of our concern is on the purpose. On the purpose, and here the real concern for us is that there's insufficient clarity on what the norms and standards will be used for, or rather more accurately, what they may be used for. And again, this relates to multiplicity of interpretations that may come from the way that the act is currently drafted, the bill is currently drafted. Going back to definition, insofar as there is no definition of the term, our recommendation is that the term needs to be adequately defined in the bill. In this regard, and we do understand that the definition of norms and standards will be specified in the regulations, but prior to the regulations being ushered in, there's just these recommendations, these three recommendations we'd like to make. And we recommend that the norms and standards should be defined with reference to the level of quality required to ensure the health and safety of the users of our facilities, South African facilities, healthcare facilities. And we would like explicitly an exclusion of any cost or tariff in any way relating to the price or value of any health service provided in or from a public health establishment or in any private health establishment. Our exclusion there that we would like to propose is not to create a gap, but it's to the extent that we believe that that is a function that should be delegated to a properly qualified authority that should be set up to deal with that particular aspect. But the way that the bill is phrased now, it can lead people to believe that they could actually scope that into the functions of the provisions of this bill. And therefore, what we are trying to prevent or avoid is scope creep that can come in due to the lack of clarity on some of these crucial issues. And then lastly, this also excludes the treatment process to be followed in a and the clinical standards or clinical pathways relating to a particular diagnosis. This is a point that has been made several times here, that there are accreditation processes that relate to the actual clinical standards and professional standards and scopes that are already in existence. There is no gap there. It's just that the bill must find a way of fitting neatly into what is already there and is already working perfectly. I think that if we look at section 79.B.3 of the bill, you just on that point in number 3, it actually reads like this, and I think this is where, this is the section that needs to be strengthened to actually cater for this. I'll read it very quickly. It says, the chief executive officer may enter into contracts with any person or organization or appoint expert or technical committees to assist the office in the performance of its functions, including conducting inspections. And I think this speaks about delegation of some of the technical aspects of the accreditation process that might become relevant in the work of this committee. And this is now the what that we are recommending with regard to. And now the process, again, believing that there will be regulations that will specify how exactly, what exactly these standards will be, we do feel that the principles that must lead us and help us in conducting that process are the following. The process must be expert-led in collaboration with stakeholders, all stakeholders, relevant stakeholders, and there must be international benchmarking as an emphasis within that process, and there has to be a process of public participation. And in essence, what we are recommending here is that as we craft the process of regulations, these are some of the key elements that must come and strengthen that process. Then we go on to the purpose of the norms and standards. Our concern there is that there's insufficient clarity on what the office will use these norms and standards for. The bill states that the office will inspect, certify, and monitor compliance. There's been a lot of talk about accreditation in earlier presentations as I was listening. The bill does not mention anything about accreditation. I speak under correction, but I think I've read it quite a few times. But however, regardless of the fact that it's silent about accreditation, and it doesn't deal sufficiently with it, there is the issue that the licensure, the issuing of licenses for the health facilities are implicit. The bill says that the office will license. It doesn't say that, but you can see that it must be the office that will license. But because of the link with licensure, the issue of accreditation now becomes important because it is the basis for which the licensure will be conducted. I think there needs to be some clarity on accreditation in the bill. It must say something about accreditation. It will leave a big gap if it doesn't, because it's a big part of the mix. It comes into the mix, accreditation. And we would like to point that accreditation is a highly technical process requiring appropriately qualified agencies. I think we've spent this morning listening to pathologists telling us how complex the accreditation process is and how it has evolved over a number of decades all over the world and all that. I think this is just to emphasize that point. In fact, the very accreditation of health facilities in a non-specialized way, just the facility, is itself a very complex process, and I think some of the agencies that do accreditation currently in the country, like COSASA, if one looks at how they conduct those accreditations, one then gets to appreciate that, and that is relevant now to what is envisaged in the bill, the type of facility that is being targeted by this bill. And then you get to appreciate the complexity and the technicalities that go into the accreditation process. And the question that we all need to ask, will the office acquire these skills and keep them in-house, or will it get these skills and be innovative in how it sources and uses these skills? And our submission is that the technical capacity to do this is likely to reside with a third party outside of the office. But again, that portion that I read does allow for this. The one that allows the CEO to delegate to other agencies, even outside of the office. The last part, the second part and the big part of our recommendations relates to the fact that the office needs to have checks and balances to ensure a few things, mainly the legality and the integrity of the office. The legality is just mainly to ensure that there is compliance with the Constitution and the principles of administrative law. And the integrity is what we would like to go a little bit in depth on. And the issues there are independence, neutrality and transparency, and the competence and effectiveness of the office. These are things that we would like to be enshrined in the office as it is being established. And in order to ensure or assure of these checks and balances, they will only be secured through appropriate structures and appropriate functionaries to ensure that the checks and balances are in there. And before I go to the next slide, I think it is important for us that the checks and balances must be such that the office is itself self-sufficient and not requiring assistance from outside for it to run efficiently and function properly and effectively. And it is through those structures that the office is set up with upfront, and the functionaries and how they do their work upfront, that will ensure that it's not a burden on other organs of state in terms of there being complaints and there being grievances of some sort. We propose a board of health standards, and the principles for the establishment of this, we recommend that this should be formed, and this board should be politically independent and neutral, eliminating any potential bias towards either the public and or the private sector. In other words, it must just look at what is best for the patients and what is best for the country. This board, the board of health standards, independence and neutrality are imperative also to ensure that there is accountability directly to stakeholders and the communities they serve. One of the big errors we can commit in establishing a structure like this is to create a structure that has got no accountability to stakeholders, and its whole lifespan is spent in fights with the stakeholders instead of it being embracing of stakeholders and working with stakeholders. And we've seen this with many other structures in the past, and this is one of the lessons that we feel that we have learned by now, or we should have learned. The board should be, together with the office, is part of the function of this establishment, and the juristic person, the bill states that already. And it should be funded by levies payable, the office now, levies payable by the health establishments, both public and private. I think that's the Section 3 PFMA entity that some people have referred to. And we would like to emphasize that this is our preferred way of structuring the office, rather than it being a Section 9 company that reports to Parliament. In other words, it still falls within the jurisdiction of the Ministry of Health. The board is the composition of the board. We propose that four members must be appointed directly by the private sector. Four members must be appointed directly by the minister, and we assume, I must make that point, that the minister will take in doing so, will take into account the interest of representativity from the public sector. And then that's 8 out of 12. And then the other 4 will be experts, should be experts, we suggest, in law, public health, pharmacoeconomics, and hospital management. Over and above that, the 13th member we propose should be the chairman. The chairperson will be appointed by the board following a public nomination process we propose. The office itself consists of the following key appointments: the chief executive officer and his support staff or her support staff, the health officers and inspectors, those are already I think provided for in the bill. We also ask that there should be an appeal board as part of the process and the structure of the office, and the ombud is already provided for. The CEO HAFSA recommends the following: the board to nominate at least 3 persons for the position of CEO using whatever means they feel as a board is best to do that. Provide those 3 nominations to the minister, and the minister makes his choice out of those after taking any further inputs he may require from the board to assist him in making that appointment. Once appointed, we propose that the CEO must work under the direct supervision of the board. Health officers and inspectors are provided for in the bill. The only thing we would like to add there is that the inspectors, we feel, should be appointed by the CEO and accountable to the CEO. The health officers, we feel the bill is saying that they will be appointed by the relevant level of the relevant tier of government, be it local, provincial, or national. We just would like to add that they must be appointed on the recommendation of or in consultation with the CEO, because after all, they will be working with the CEO. The appeal board, we recommend that it should have the right, health establishments that are operating under this bill, which will probably become the act, that will be operating under the act, should have the right to appeal. Should have the right to appeal or review of a notice of non-compliance by an inspector in terms of the provisions of 82A1. The minister and the board, we recommend they should, between them, appoint an appeal board, and this must be an appeal board that is really got teeth. We recommend it should be chaired by a learned, I don't know, colleague or friend, a judge or a retired judge or magistrate, and it should have 2 other people in it who are appointed on account of their broad knowledge and expertise in the healthcare industry. The appeal board may confirm, may set aside, or vary any decisions of the office. I think that's the whole point of setting an appeal board, is to provide another layer that allows for escalation of issues. I must say that I'm drawing towards the conclusion now. This is the last two slides, I think, 2 or 3 slides. And then the ombud, the only thing we really would like to say with the ombud is that to prevent what we regard as turf wars in terms of who must do what between the appeal board, the office, and the ombud. The ombud should, the work of the ombud should be done, should be to resolve complaints on a voluntary basis and to make non-binding recommendations to the office, but nevertheless make recommendations. And that the ombud should be bound not to disclose any confidential information to relating to the investigations he has made. To finish off our presentation, we would like to just share some international experience with you. Insofar as the separation of health standards which are envisaged in the bill, which is the main thrust of this bill, from the clinical standards which I mentioned later and the tariff setting and processes. There is international precedence in the UK. The Department of Health defines the quality standards, which is the concerns of this particular bill, which is what we think even in South Africa should be replicated. It should be the function of the Department of Health to do that. Tariff setting is currently performed by the DOH in the UK, but this is a completely separate process from the standard setting, so there is a different authority within the Department of Health there. And new legislation is now being ushered in the UK, which will actually take it separately out of the Department of Health. That's the direction they are moving in. And there's a separate independent body that's got a nice name, as you can see there, and the acronym is also nice. It defines the clinical standards and scopes. And the last slide is further international experience. This one is experience about independence and neutrality of regulators internationally. And our view is that we are now, through this bill, trying to come up with a regulator that is similar to the ones that we've mentioned there. And the slides have been distributed in hard copy, but the countries that we looked at, and there's many other countries we could have looked at, are Canada, Germany, and Netherlands. Those are OECD countries, which stands for cooperation and development. I can't remember the acronym. But the point is this. Those countries have got universal access in place, all of them, and generally regarded as having functional and well-functioning health systems. And therefore, we see them, not only them and many other countries that have covered the ground that is covered in these countries, as the countries that have health systems that are aspirational to a country that is at our level of development. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Bomela. That is it, members. Clarity, questions? It's about the norms and standards as to what are these and how the whats and the hows, and the suggestion that this is what we would like to see in the structure. Somebody, I think it was you, Mangombo, you talked about regulations, and this, some of these things want to be covered in regulations, on the regulations. But I see Maso Khwale, I see Mangombo, I see Umadube. Okay. Is that...
Thank you, Chairperson, and thanks for the presentation. On the recommendation, whereby it's been recommended that there should be a Board of Health of Standards, whereby we talk about the composition of that board, whereby we do have three bullets, which says four members appointed directly by the minister. Then the second one says four members appointed by the private sector. I would like to know why are we differentiating? Because when the presenter was explaining, he said that the four members appointed by the minister will be from the maybe public, yeah, whatever. My take always says that at a certain stage you see the minister as minister of public service, and he's the minister of health. Why should the private sector be given a special treat whereby which the minister is not involved, whereas the public, the minister is involved? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. I think my two men, then one other person.
Chairperson, even myself, it's I'm a little bit worried about the composition, because when we talk of the board that is going to deal with health issues, as a layman in the street, I think we need to move away from being too professional and forget that those hospitals are for patients. Do you have a room for whoever is going to represent patients, especially because the wrong things have been done on them? So even on the appeal board, I don't see us talking anything about the patients, because even if we talk of experts, a patient is also an expert in his or her own right. Another question is in relation to the neutral person. I just want to check with you, who is a neutral person? Because you say the board to be both politically independent and neutral. What does neutral mean? Because I don't get it. To me, I see everybody on the day of voting going to vote. So who's going to be neutral? Thank you.
Thank you very much for the presentation. Ooh, at least it was, you know, one could breathe with this presentation. It had a bit of what we want, but apart from that, I have been covered partly by the previous speaker, that is there no room for civil society, members of the civil society, to be in the board, so that like we do in NEDLAG and all other structures, so that we are not in the in the appeals board, no, in the board, for fairness, so that as that other lady was saying, the community was up in arms. What can we do that the community does not go up in arms? And then this is, by the way, we are busy getting ready for NHI, and we'll be visiting some countries who are already having universal coverage. These three countries that you said have got universal coverage, so also they've got the Office of Standards Compliance as well.
Thank you. I found the presentation very interesting, and it will be good for us to discuss some of these things you've mentioned when the department are with us in committee, so we can test some of these thoughts. The one thing I'm not very clear about is, right in the beginning when you spoke about the need for a definition of the term norms and standards, and then under that was purpose, and it's insufficient clarity on what norms and standards will be used for. And I haven't really, for me, quite picked up on what you're meaning there, and what we should be specifically zoning in on there. Thanks.
Those are the questions. I didn't say, okay.
Thank you, Chair. I'm just asking a point of clarity. Under the Ombudsman, he just said that the role of the Ombudsman is to resolve complaints on a voluntary basis and to make non-binding recommendations. If maybe you can just clarify to us.
Thank you. He's from Free State. He went there because the grandparents were working in mines there, and he ended up staying in Bloemfontein. No, I'm joking. You can respond to those questions. The interesting thing is that we...
Thank you, Sebastian. I think mine is on the question of the recommendation that says the board to nominate two persons for the position of CEO, but only once nominated to be the names to be sent to the minister to appoint one, meaning that to shortlist the three to one to appoint, and to work under and. This person was appointed to work under the direct supervision of the board. And also, what I want to ask, as Mangowa has appointed on the issue of the reason why this office has got to be changed because of the problems we see in the health. Now, I don't know whether, are they not now reducing this effect of why is this office now being... established, as Honourable Ngoma has stated, that there is a reason, because the state of health in South Africa is in tatters. That is the reason why. Now reducing this, is it? I'm not quite sure if now they are saying this bill must be nominated by the board and not by the minister, as stated in the amendment bill, that the minister is to appoint this person, and also what are they saying by the five-year term, which is once, it is not renewable. What are they saying also about this term of office of 5 years in the of the 5 years in the position? Lastly, what else can I say? Now it is said that the OSS is accountable, to ensure that the OSHSC is accountable directly to the stakeholders and community themselves. I wonder, do we think that will make the efforts better? Of now that we are facing a crisis, even now, if now we are trying now to take it back, we are reversing this to this nomination, to this new nomination process. Thank you, Chairperson.
Let me confirm that there's nobody. My home girl, you are the only one that didn't ask. You don't want to ask, so that I can go to them.
Chair, I think most of the questions have been asked by others. Don't want to duplicate. Thank you.
Thank you, home girl. No, she's my home girl. It's so interesting that this side, we always talk of affirmative action on the historically disadvantaged, but it's so interesting. We need affirmative action here. Because I only see the historically disadvantaged people leading the organization. Where are the whites? I don't see the whites. No, don't answer. They don't qualify. Okay, don't answer that. It's so interesting that I was with a journalist, and she was asking me about some of the things. I forgot whether his section or his chapter. I think you fell into the same trap. Dr. Pumela, where the section 9 or section 3 or chapter 9 or chapter whatever, they always confuse, and I'm glad that they confuse you too, because you talked about section 9 and it's chapter 9, and I was corrected by journalists that it's chapter 9. But I think if you could answer, but what we must understand is that the Department of Health, just like the portfolio community, were just looking at our communities and bettering their lives. But we want to listen to everybody. You might be interested in your small corner, but accept that we are going to take your suggestions and we are going to relook at them and see where we, but at the end of the day, our interest is to make sure that everybody benefits from what we're doing. So we're asking everybody to come in their small corners, but at the end of the day, we want something, we're thinking that we're neutral. I'm not sure whether we're neutral, but we're thinking that we're neutral. Our aim is to make sure that every South African benefits from this bill that we're trying to amend.
Sir, I just some clarity questions on the switch post. Since the CEO proposed the establishment of the appeals board within the board itself that he proposed. I was just wondering what happened with the appeals tribunal. That is intended by the bill where you can escalate your complaints to once you're not satisfied or when you ask for a review for the sense of the decisions of the board of the office. Because there is an appeals tribunal that is proposing the bill in all of that. So that is the thing if you have come to that. And that's the first question. The second question is about, for instance, the ombudsman. Having regard to the fact that the previous day there was this strong advocacy as to the teeth of the ombudsman in the bill, there is proposing that it must be voluntary and it must make non-binding, for instance, non-binding recommendation. So what is this take on that? Because other people, what are people that we're talking about the teeth of the ombudsman?
No, you know, the only people that I don't like in this world is the lawyers. So that's why we need to make this bill so that we never get a time to go to the lawyers. Because when you get to the lawyers, it's when things are very bad. That's why I don't like lawyers. I want to make sure that we can have appeals and sort these things out. Okay, you can answer the question. I see you are left-handed.
Yes, I am, Chair. Thank you to the members of honourable members for the questions. And before I answer the questions, I should have indicated that I am with a team from HASA who are sitting next and behind me. And once I've answered the questions, I'm sure they may want to make further clarity if the Honorable Chair allows it. The last questions I will deal with are the first, second, and third questions that were asked, simply because I feel that there might be some additional comments from my colleagues on those questions. So I will deal with the question backwards. With regard to the appeals and ombuds, our view is that within the structures in the office, complaints, the structures that are in the office, between the office, the CEO, the ombuds, and the appeals committee, between them they should be able to conclusively dispose of complaints, and the arrangements about the powers within them, I think there could be some flexibility as long as there is assurance to the public that when there is a complaint, both from a member of the public or there is an appeal from an institution that has had a complaint laid against it, as long as that can be disposed of conclusively without needing to call in the lawyers that the Honorable Chair was referring to, or without going to the courts. We think that that is a suitable regime, and we are not really particular of between those three who must have which power above which one. So therefore, our proposed structure is an attempt to achieve that. And perhaps the difference between what we've proposed and what may have been discussed or proposed earlier on is that we bring in the committee, the appeals committee, as a necessary and a powerful part of the structure, which now we feel that has got implications on the originally envisaged powers of the ombuds that were stated in the bill as currently drafted. So we are not at odds or at variance with people that feel that it should be a different mix in terms of powers, but as long as it can achieve what I've just said. Then in terms of the three names, both the board and the minister, and the term of 5 years, anything we haven't commented on, we don't have an issue with, such as the term of 5 years and that it can be 2 terms. We don't have an issue with that. The process of 3 names as a minister is that we must say that upfront, it may not have been expressed explicitly that we have no intention of diminishing the role and the authority of the minister over any process in healthcare in this country, including this office. By virtue of the authority vested in him, the minister may intervene in any process with any authority because he is the delegated authority of government in keeping with the Constitution of the Republic, in pursuit of the progressive realization of health. And if it could have appeared that we have any intention of diminishing the minister's role in that regard, I think that was not intended. And therefore, in terms of the process we've proposed of 3 names being handed to the minister, it's in recognition of the minister's role, as I've just said. The issue of proposing 3 names, we envisage, is names that will have been screened, gone through a rigorous process of appointment, and be found to have been suitable by the board using the best methodologies of assessing suitability of candidates for this kind of a role. And therefore, we feel that it sort of brings in that balance, and it will also bring in the due authority into the process that the minister is at any event entitled to. In terms of the ombuds, I think I've already answered when I answered the question about the ombuds together with the appeal and the CEO and how they interact with each other. It's just the outcome that we are interested in there. We are not really worried who's got more powers than who can subpoena and who can make a binding. It's just we felt that it will create less friction if the 3 structures of appeal committee, CEO, and ombuds are structured in the way we've suggested. The purpose of the norms and standards, I think there was a question from the honorable member at the back. The purpose, what we are saying is that the purpose for which the office intends to use the norms and standards should be clear. And by that we mean our view is that the norms and standards should be the floor of what should be the minimum of what should be achieved. And therefore, if the office has got that view too, Then some of the questions that were asked earlier were in some of the institutions or the elements within the healthcare establishment that we're presenting are saying we have actually gone way beyond the standard that is minimum through international accreditation and some other accreditations that they may have been subjected to through the course of their work. What we are saying is that the office must use the purpose of this standard is a minimum. It must not be a ceiling or it must not be a boundary. And therefore, in spite of the standards, it must allow and strive for excellence because we think that's what the South African population deserves. So it is purpose in that sense. And I know it may not have come clearly in the presentation as I was making it. Then I'll deal with the first three questions that were asked, which I think my colleagues may have a view on as well. Let me remind the House what those questions are. They relate to the board being 4-4 and the suggestion that we're actually promoting a separation and a division or a two-tier system. We are propagating a two-tier system. That's the first question. The second question was, what is the meaning of neutrality? What do we mean when you use that term? And the third question was the issue of community representativity within the structure of the board. When I answer now, I'll deal with all three of them in my answer because they are interlinked. We have really thought very carefully about making this recommendation. And that circumspection was mainly due to the effect that whatever we do must recognize the current reality and the evolution that we have had up till this point. And by that I mean we have a reality that there is a public sector and a private sector currently, which we are trying to move away from as envisaged in the policy and objectives of the NHI. So in terms of being able to move from there moving forward, we can use a whole number of approaches. We can use an idealistic, we can use an ideological approach, or we can use an approach that is informed by facts and current reality. The issue of not using current realities as our basis, as the basis of our action, is that it lands us into legal proceedings and into complaints and fights within the health sector, and that drags us and it delays us from moving forward. The current reality right now is that there is a unique expertise and way of doing things that has over time evolved to reside specifically within the private sector. It's a fact. Whether it's unfortunate or it was not supposed to happen or it was supposed to happen, I'm not commenting on that. And there is something that is unique that resides within the private sector as it stands now. There is something that is unique and resides within the public sector as it stands now. That's the current reality we are in. If we start moving from a position that says, let's look at the numbers, the private sector is this much, the public sector is this much, we already have a false start in the sense that you've already got people who are agreed starting off with. And this takes me to the term neutrality, as I was saying, as I was mentioning. The meaning of neutrality must be contrasted from the meaning of independence. Neutrality and independence are not interchangeable as I use them. Independence is from influences outside of the structure itself, so that the structure able to function within its resources and deliver and become effective. Neutrality is just in terms of the two-tier system, which is the current reality in South Africa that we have to deal with. We may choose to ignore it on ideological grounds or any other grounds as we usher in this law. But let's just be careful that we do not aggrieve other people that are important and are already players within the health system. And that is the reason why we felt that there will be no questions asked by anyone if one says that there is this kind of representativity that is not elevating one or the other within these two sectors, which takes us now to the community representatives. These eight people, four from the private sector, presumably from the public sector, are the community representatives that we thought need to, because there is no specification on their qualifications. In other words, they come from a different background but are representing the community one way or another. For instance, I'll make an example. I think when we talk of, the ones that would be coming from the public sector, I would imagine that it's less difficult to understand how they could come from the community in the sense of the way that the public sector is set and represents and is consumed by the great majority, including the poorest of the poor. The ones that come from the private sector, in our view, and we may be wrong, in our view, it's people that come from that background are South Africans and represent community aspirations, but from a different South African background. What I think perhaps may have been omitted that people may feel we could have put into the structure is direct civil society nominations representation. If that is what is being suggested, we feel that that would we are not adverse to that, because it really would work to advance the work of this committee. But I think there's no lack of community representation in the structure that we have proposed, because the only people that are really being proposed on the basis of special knowledge or some other speciality are the other four that are listed, but the other eight are de facto community representatives. Thank you. Thank you.
I'd love if my colleague behind wants to add something. I don't want to spoil a good response from my colleague.
No, indeed, it was a good response. I expected it. That's why I was asking that he was left-handed. I think one thing that you must understand that is that, you know, I was born in rural areas from poor parents. They never bought toys for me. So the way I used to enjoy myself is to pull other people's legs. So that's why I like pulling people's legs and say you are the reverse of the affirmative action. So don't respond to those questions. Okay, thank you for that. Coming back to him, he's left-handed and he's got a bad handwriting. I've read the research that says people who are left-handed and those who got a bad handwriting are more brilliant than those. It's research work. So that's why his response is very simple.
Chair. Okay, so my colleague wants to. This is Sarika Beshesa. She is she's a researcher in healthcare.
She wants to confirm what I've just said.
You want to confirm what I've said?
No, I just want to add regarding the purpose of the office. There was a question and to say that there's lack of clarity. And we just want to know for sure: is the office going to be doing accreditation? Is it going to be doing licensing, or is it going to be doing certification? And if you look internationally, those three processes are very different. So we need to know exactly what will the office be doing. Is it which one of the three processes? And then just lastly, I just think the reason why we punted for a board is for an independent board is that, you know, a lot of money is being spent in South Africa and the healthcare system. And as a public citizen, we want to know that our money, be it public or private, is being spent properly and we've been taken care of. And having a regulator that is completely independent will allow for us to have confidence in our healthcare system, be it public or private. Thank you.
You are asking us questions, and unfortunately we're not going to respond to those questions. We've put a draft bill, and we want your comments as to that draft. So we can't answer yes or no. All we're going to do, we're going to take all the suggestions that you have brought to us, and then sit down again at the bill and see where do we fit what. As I said, you are a specific center of South Africa that deals with private hospital industry. There are others who are coming, like the path lab, that the path care that are coming. So everybody must come. At the end of the day, neutral as we are and objective as we are, we're going to sit down and look at all those things for the benefit of South Africans. Whether they are poor, whether they are rich, whether they are white, whether they are black, whether they are old, whether they are young, but we'll be doing it for South Africans. And as we said, we are a government of the people, by the people, for the people. That's what we're trying to do. Okay. We're not going to answer your question, but we'll take your suggestions. Members, if there's nothing on HASA, then we go on to the next one. Thank you very much, HASA. Thank you, Dr. Pomela. Thank you, Dr. Tanaki. Thank you, lady. I thought there were no females in your organization. At least there's somebody. The only thing that you need to do is put in a few whites so that there's affirmative action in your organization. You're reversing apartheid, because I can see that. Okay. The next group. Presentation by Financial Planning Institute of Southern Africa and BUSA, Business Unity South Africa, BUSA. Sajupo men, any lady galalini teacher mo chapter no section, lebe mfawa koi. Section 9. Let's wait for a few minutes while they are connecting their gadgets. Are you ready? So I'm not sure whether you have been sitting here, so you know the members of the portfolio committee. If you know them, then we don't have to introduce ourselves. So we'll give over to you. The only person that I know is Lee. Can you introduce yourself and then make the presentation?
I think I'll just introduce myself again to the members who may not know me. My name is Lee Pediachi. I'm the head of Business Unity South Africa's Cape Town office, our parliamentary office, which focuses on parliament. And for those who may not know about BUSA, BUSA is the largest business confederation in South Africa. But to correct you, Chair, we are not the richest. We are a not-for-profit organization. We represent over 50 member organizations, which equals about 90% of South African business, including thousands of small businesses. And we are committed to ensuring that business is a key partner to government in achieving national goals of poverty alleviation, job creation, and transformation. Importantly, we represent business at NEDLAC, which is the key platform for us to engage with social partners on socioeconomic legislation. Today, we are going to be doing our presentation in conjunction with one of our members, the Financial Planning Institute. Their representative, Mr. Andre Jacobs, is a member of BUSA's Social Policy Standing Committee. He is representing both BUSA and the FBI today. Andre is joined by his colleague from the FPI, Mr. Mr. Elmo Lubowski. Since we are both raising the same issues, we thought we would save the committee's time by delivering a joint presentation. On to you, Andre.
Yes, I just wanted to do an introduction for the FPI, as I'm directly employed by the FPI, the Financial Planning Institute. Part of the reason for giving the overviews is to just give the Portfolio Committee some idea of where we fit in and why we are making comments. Okay, just first to give you some background, the Financial Planning Institute is the premier independent professional body in financial services with over 30 years of service and being the forerunner in setting financial planning standards and representing professional financial planners. Many of our members are obviously healthcare advisors, and the FBI currently has approximately 7,000 members and is affiliated to the Financial Standards Board internationally, the Ethics Institute of South Africa, and obviously Business Unity South Africa, which we are a member of and which we're doing a joint presentation with at the moment. The role of the financial planner, particularly in highly regulated healthcare environment, has obviously changed very substantially.
Maybe just to tell you a little bit.
Yeah.
Members, apparently we've been given a document by both BUSA and FPI, but apparently this document has been amended, so we better look at the screens.
Yeah, it hasn't been amended to a huge degree. It was just a couple of additions, but I think they'll be pointed out. The first one was, on the first slide, my surname was just a little bit wrong. that was the first change that needed to be made. Basically, just in terms of, as I said, in terms of the Financial Planning Institute, as a lot of these changes now are being made, I think, and it was mentioned, in view of national health and starting to improve the healthcare system, we want to be involved in an early stage, because we believe our members are very well positioned and are providing the public with a lot of healthcare advice, and we believe there's value in that advice. Just in short, if you look at, according to the Council for Medical Schemes, $1.3 billion was paid to independent advisors. This equates to about 2.4 million members represented by advisors, and we do believe we have a role to play within NHI, and we do support, and we've made those comments in terms of NHI, that we do support the concept, but we do feel that we are in a position to assist in the process going forward, and therefore we wanted to also make a presentation today in order to start sharing some of our views on this. I won't take any further time and actually get into the meat of this and therefore our chairman of our health committee and also as said representative of some of the BUSA committees on this, Mr. Andre Jacobs.
Thank you. Honourable members and honourable chair, I think just as a general comment, the establishment of the Office for Health Standards Compliance and the Office of the Health Ombud, I think is widely supported and definitely supported by the two organisations that I represent, BUSA and the Financial Planning Institute. We also want to note that we believe that the additions to the National Health Bill as proposed is in line with the 10-point plan that government have embarked on. And most of the discussions and comment that we see in media relates to the National Health Insurance proposals, where actually National Health Insurance is only one of the components of the 10-point plan. And we see that this is a further realization of the objectives of the 10-point plan, which we support. The additionals, we believe, lay the foundation for improved health delivery and protect the consumers of healthcare. And basically, from a BUSA perspective and from the financial planning perspective, we do represent the interest of the consumer in that regard. So when we speak to this house, we don't profess that we have health experience, but we speak to you from the interest of the consumer. And that's for us immensely important. And what we want to share with this house in your deliberations going forward is some of the successes in Mexico, where the healthcare system was used as a social cohesion and sort of a national pride. And I think that's immensely important. We had immense successes in South Africa with the Soccer World Cup. There was a lot of doom prophets saying we will never pull it off. And 2 days before the time, one of the BBC reporters, I think, said that, you know, the stadium in Soweto is half built and there's gaps in it, not actually knowing that that's how it was designed. But we had a very successful Soccer World Cup, and we learned a lot of lessons as a nation in terms of how to achieve something, and we did exactly the same with the Rugby World Cup in 85. So to be able to do that, we require the involvement of all stakeholders to, in concert with society's needs, co-design and co-manage a transformed quality and affordable healthcare system that is responsive to the citizens' needs. And I think we heard somebody asking a question to the House about civil society and not being satisfied with some of the health facilities. And it must be responsive to the needs of the citizens. The expertise that we offer from business, organized labor and civil society, we believe should be leveraged to ensure adequate governance and checks and balances are established to enhance the accountability of the Office of Health Standards Compliance and the Ombud. And we believe that we have an enormous amount of value that we can add and that we are prepared to add to a transformed healthcare system. In terms of the specific sections of the Act, we respectfully want to offer some amendments or suggest some amendments, and those amendments are highlighted. And it talks about the appointment of the CEO, and it talks about the appointment of the Ombud. And in that, we respectfully suggest that consideration is given to adding that the minister should appoint after consultation with NEDLAC. And I will explain in the next slides why we specifically say that. And then in terms of the ombud, because we serve the consumer, we also suggest in section 81 capital A that there's an additional section added that the ombud should consult where appropriate and desirable with the consumer commissioner. And I think there's a lot of value to be gained in achieving consumer protection by also fostering formal relationships with the consumer commissioner. If we take a bit of a reference to what a World Health Organization have said, and this specific paper of the World Health Organization actually has as its heading, it's everybody's business. And healthcare is everybody's business. And what I'm talking about, and I've highlighted certain things in red, it says all organizations, people and actions, private providers, health insurance, behavior change programs, organizations. So it talks about all those issues, and it talks about the fact that it's not only, that's the definition of a health system, but it speaks about a principle that healthcare is really everybody's business, and the healthcare system accommodates everybody in that system, and that it is not a system that is only aligned to the people that can pay for healthcare, and it speaks about the principle that everybody then acquires healthcare on their need and pays according to their means. If we then look at the World Health Organization's health system framework, they talk about six building blocks, and our proposals in terms of possible amendments to the Act is really speaking about the block number six, which is leadership and governance. And the overall outcomes of those six building blocks is that you have improved health responsiveness, social and financial risk protection, and improved efficiency. And we believe that our suggestions that we have made to this house to be considered would actually lead to improved efficiency. When the World Health Organization then speaks about leadership and governance, and I want to draw your attention only to the last sentence, it says, while ultimately it is the responsibility of government, this does not mean all leadership and governance functions have to be carried out by central ministries of health. And we believe very strongly that if we leverage the expertise in the public sector, in the private sector, in civil society, and in organized labor, that we will achieve a system where everybody is involved, everybody is responsible, and everybody will then be able to assist in transforming the healthcare system. That's a duplication of the slide. Then there is certain precedent, and seeing that the Honorable Chair likes to pull people's legs, I thought it's appropriate to start with the Honorable Chair. That actually said that private sector, civics, and organized labor play a vital role in combating HIV/AIDS. And I think that's immensely important. The governance model in the UIF fund consists of the private sector, civic organizations, and organized labor and government. The state president consult the Judicial Services Commission before appointing judges. And members of the Council for Medical Schemes are appointed from the private sector after open nominations. And then lastly, the 10-point plan speaks about improving communication and consultation within the health system and between the health system and the communities it serves. And for that specific reason, we have made our suggestions that we would respectfully request this house to consider. We believe that the advantages of our proposal is that the private sector, civic organizations, and organized labor will become part of the solution and not stand on the side and criticize and try to prevent. The health system reform, as I've said, and where we have taken leave from the World Health Organization, is everybody's responsibility to co-design and co-ownership of the healthcare system, and we will achieve this by the proposal, we believe. And we will reduce polarization between healthcare reform and the private sector. Also in accelerated delivery, we believe that should this process be followed, that the appointment of the CEO and the ombud need not be justified thereafter, and that the appointee can then focus on the task at hand and not justify, for the first year, justify in the media why that specific person must be appointed and why he's competent, but actually that people can roll up their sleeves and start working immediately. Then, to conclude, BUSA and its members are committed to, in concert with society's needs, co-design and co-manage a transformed quality and affordable healthcare system that is representative of the needs of all citizens. BUSA and FPI then have to thank this house for the opportunity to be able to share our views, commitment and support with the Portfolio Committee on Health. And we thank you. We wish you well in the deliberations also. There's a lot of things to consider in getting a bill through and passing that bill and then not later come back, as the Honourable Chair said. We wish you well in your deliberations on that. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Lobosky talked, and it's only Lee who didn't talk, but you don't want to talk. Oh, he introduced him. Thank you very much, Andre. I didn't see you in that when I was opening that clinic. I didn't see you there, but it means you were hiding somewhere. No, thank you very much. You know, we would have been very worried if the business sector did not come and make a presentation. Because, you know, some of us are in government. We know how to spend money, but we don't know how to make it. And the people who can make it, who know how to make money, are the business people. So, for us to be able to achieve what we want to achieve, we need money. So if you come with your suggestions, we'll always welcome them. I'm going to allow the members now to questions for clarity. FPI and B, BUSA are here. Do you have any clarity questions for them? Free State, Northwest, is it the only two hands? Are there any other hands? Okay.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you for the presentation. I just wanted to find out from the presenters regarding the appointment of the ombudsman. I could see here they proposed that the minister, after consultation with the net. Pardon? Okay. I saw somebody was. Okay. According to their specific amendment, they are suggesting that the appointment of ombudsman, they say the minister must, after consultation with NEDLAG, appoint and feed a proper, suitable, and qualified person to be employed. But I wanted to find out from them their silence in terms of the role of the ombudsman and how do you see his powers after the investigation? Can he adjudicate, or how do you feel about it? So I don't hear you saying anything about that. Just maybe you can just specify, are you happy with the as it is, or what is happening?
Thank you, Chairperson. I think it's on the same specific amendment to the National LP for consideration, whereby it's been said that the minister must, after consultation with the NEDLAG, then appoint. When you look at the bill, it says that the minister must follow the public service procedure, whereby he is appointing a fit and proper and suitable qualified South African citizen. And I'm asking myself, because it's not the only, it won't be the only body where the minister is appointing people to serve in. Why why this one specifically should be in consultation with the NEDLAC. Can I just be clarified? Because there is a lot of, like in the morning we even alluded that the minister appointed the register of the South African Nursing Council, which is like doing quality around nurses. Why in this one it should be in consultation with NEDLAC? Thank you.
Honourable Chair and honourable members, I think that's two very good questions. Let me start with the last question first, and then I'll deal with the first question. And then if my colleagues also want to add to those questions, they're welcome, I think, and if the Honourable Chair will allow that. I think just on, first of all, the appointment and the public service legislation. I think we do not suggest a deviation from that. In fact, we suggest that that portion of Section 79A1 is retained, and there is no amendment to that. What we do suggest is that a point is then added, and it says after consultation. And the reason for that, I specifically want to draw the Honourable members' attention to this, and that actually frames the reason for us, and it really speaks about that we believe that we need to get a healthcare system where the public, where civil society, where organized labor are involved, and the institution where they are involved is in NEDLAC, where they take co-ownership of those specific aspects. So it's not so much as deviating. In fact, we will strongly recommend that one retains the public health system, public service legislation in terms of the appointment of people. There's good governance and there's good proper process and due process there. But we believe that in forming a transformed healthcare system, organized labor, business, and civil society needs to take hands with government and assist in that regard. And it's really a request from business to be involved in the decision making of healthcare and a transformed healthcare system. It is not to design, it is to co-design, to co-manage, to co-ownership of the healthcare system. And that, as I have highlighted, is also supported by the World Health Organization. In terms of the OMBID, in South Africa, we have a range of various OMBID in terms of the financial services industry, in terms of the short-term OMBID, the pensions OMBID, also the financial planning OMBID, financial services OMBID, and a range of other OMBIDs. But we believe very strongly that the OMBID's decision must be binding and that the OMBID must have teeth. Otherwise, there is no need for that OMBID. If the OMBID is just a person making a recommendation and is not taken seriously, we feel very strongly that the OMBID must be a person with teeth. It worked well in South Africa. It's totally unnecessary. Citizens should behave proper. There should be no need for an OMBID, but that is in a perfect society. In this regard, we cannot do without. Society is not perfect, and in an imperfect society you need checks and balances, and you need somebody sometimes to take out the stick and enforce decisions.
Thank you very much. Being satisfied, Mr. Khan? Is it because you're satisfied with the questions? Thank you very much. Once are there any other? Okay. Mom, can you?
Thank you, Chairperson. Thanks for the presentation. Just one question on the issue of bullet, the last bullet in the same slide you have been answering. You are saying that in a amended proposed section 8 to add an additional subsection that reads as follows: to OMBUD to consult where appropriate and desirable with the Consumer Trade Commissioner. My question is that, as it is said in the bill, that the OMBUD is going to work to report, to recommend, to provide reports and recommendations to the CEO, then thereafter to the Minister for Disputes. And also, what are you saying in that case? Do you think that the OMBUD had to consult the Consumer Commissioner before the CEO, or after having consulted the CEO and then the Minister, or vice versa? Or where specifically do you think this action must be done, this consultation must be done? Thank you, sir.
Yeah, Honourable Chair, Honourable Members, I think that's a very good question. Our intention is not to prescribe actually to the OMBUD in terms of how to operate. And I think the good office of an OMBUD needs to be restricted. But what we made as a suggestion in that amendment is that an OMBUD to consult where appropriate and where desirable with the Consumer Commissioner. We felt that the Consumer Protection Act is such an important piece of legislation in South Africa, and as we have heard from one of the honourable members saying that she's actually not a health expert, a doctor or a nurse, but that she's a consumer of healthcare. We believe that consumerism in healthcare is immensely important, and the protection of the consumer is important. And that a consumer commissioner have a specific view and a specific piece of legislation that deals with that. And we want to create a formal structure where the OMBUD would then be able to consult with the consumer commissioner and be able to, in certain cases, then jointly deal with the issues. And use the expertise that it will be gained in that specific office. So it's really a cooperation formalization that we are suggesting, and not a restriction of function or a restriction of process. The OMBUD, as suggested in the National Health Bill, must be able to act independently. But where the OMBUD then thinks, whether it's a male or female, that he or she needs to consult with the Consumer Commissioner, that there is a formal structure and formal authority to be able to do so, to serve the public better.
Thank you. Thank you, Andre. Members, if there are no other clarity questions. Oh, no.
Thanks for that question. But why one specific person? Because there so many others he or she can consult with. Why not consult with appropriate structures where necessary? Why the Consumer Council? I've got some reservations as I ask these questions, and I won't reveal them.
Thank you, Honourable Chair and Honourable Members. I think that's a very appropriate observation, and whilst preparing, we think adequately for this presentation, we might have heard not including the principle that the Honourable Member is actually referring to. I think that's a very important a point, that one should give consideration that the Ombudsman needs to be able to consult widely in his or her functions. The motivation, though, the underlying motivation of the suggestion is very strongly founded in the principle that consumers of healthcare are at the end of the value chain. They experience either quality care or poor care. And they experience either good service or bad service. And for that specific reason, and the importance that, that our national government have given to consumer protection, we have felt that it is important that, that we highlight them that specific point. However, I will concede that that is not the only person that the ombud would consult to, but I would respectfully ask the House to consider the maybe the inclusion of other consultation where appropriate and necessary, but the specific focus on consumerism. And I think it is very important that we create a culture in South Africa where we focus in the healthcare on collaboration with, between organized labor, business, and civil society, and also have, when we do that, a focus on the end user, which is the consumer.
Thank you very much, Andre. I don't see any hands. Oh, you want to take another bite, Pat?
Last point, Chair. I just wanted to find out what is their feeling or their position regarding the independence of the office. Many presenters previously, they just said that for the method that the appointment of the CEO, the ombudsman in that office has been done by the minister himself, and secondly, for the method that the norms and standards have been prescribed by the minister, it doesn't show any independence. Can you just maybe tell us what's your position on that?
Honourable Chair and honourable members, I think that's also a very good observation. I don't know whether I want to give a direct answer to the question. It is not about, and I would respectfully suggest that in the deliberations that the House do not address necessarily the issue of independence. For us, our proposal rather focuses on a different thinking pattern, and we talk about co-ownership, co-management, and co-responsibility. When we have that, we are all part of it. We are never going to get, and I think one of the members actually spoke about or made a comment about independence. You're never going to get a body that is fully independent. I think the honourable member said people vote it. So they have a position. They represent somebody. They have a position. They are paid by somebody. They have a position. So they are not necessarily independent. And that is the reason why we are strongly motioning for a co-design, co-ownership, co-management. And I think when we achieve that, we all take responsibility. We can then not blame government or the minister or the Department of Health for doing certain things, but we are part of the problem and part of the solution. And that is the thinking that business and the Financial Planning Institute would like to share with the committee to actually consider.
Thank you very much. I think that with that last point that you said, I think it's very important. And even before you come, you know, this co-management, we are saying that we're a government of the people, by the people, for the people. And if that be the case, it is the people that are doing things. It is the people that are voting. Now, if something goes wrong, we should not point fingers at a particular person, but it's all of us who have actually made it to fail. So I think that point is very important. Okay, you can come to that.
Honorable Chair, I think that's, just to reiterate, I think it's not so much as the detail in terms of when we suggest in consultation with NEDLAC. I think the reason why that was mentioned is because NEDLAC is a forum which represents labor, civil society, as well as business. It's not to say that needs to be the exact inclusion or in the legislation, but I think the principle remains that you want that inclusion. of those people in the appointment and running of the system. And as the committee, I think you need to look forward. As I said in the beginning, this is obviously the start of a national health insurance that is going to be something far in the future. And we want to get certain of these things, I think, right now. And if you want to take a different step, and I think the Honourable Member mentioned as to why should it be a little bit different to the appointment of, other appointments made, it's just the principle that I think we need to start being more inclusive in this area, and that fingers stop getting pointed, and that we actually get to the deliverables. And if we look at international models on social security generally, and more specifically NHI, it's shown that a governance model like that works when you include the different parties of a country, and those are usually civil society, government, labour, and business. I think in South Africa we've added civil society, which is not necessarily a world labour organisation model. But we've added civil society, which is very important. The point is all those parties need to, I think, be involved in the process, and that includes appointments such as the CEO and a board, and as well as an ombud. I think that's the principle.
Thank you very much. I'm not sure whether members, before we call it, we ask them to step off that seat that they're sitting in, and we call somebody else to take over that position. If there are no further clarities, thank you very much. As I said at the beginning, that we people who are in government, we know how to spend money, but we don't know how to make it. And the business people, they know how to make it. They might not know how to spend it. We spend it for them. Thank you very much. Even the attitude that you came with, I think it has answered a lot of other questions. We'll take your suggestions and we'll look at them when we're looking at the bill again, so that the final document is going to be something that is going to cover everybody in South Africa. And there's one part that in your blogs that you mentioned about improved efficiency. You know that that can mean a lot of things. But I think the most important thing here is that any government or any organizations, because of human resources, if human resources are sick, they are always getting sick or they die, then you can't have an organization. So basically about health reforms is to make sure that we've got good human resources, mentally and physically, that can help us and improve our organization within South Africa. It's not my organization as the political or not the political, but the organization for me is South Africa. We need to improve the human resources of South Africa and we can better our country. Thank you very much. Yeah, we'll always consult you as you requested, but if we've got anything that we want to ask you, we'll always consult you. We met on HIV and AIDS, but we never met again. We'll talk about the HIV and AIDS and we'll continue the relationship. Thank you very much. Members, the lunch is ready for everybody. Even Busa and FBI are invited. So the lunch is ready outside. Let's just have lunch and then we'll come back in 45 minutes.
I must be honest, I don't. Yeah,
otherwise. Who can I write you for a copy of your presentation?
You can ask me. I'll
okay.
Send you a copy.
All right. Thank you so much.
Which one?
PUG. Yeah, I've got a list here, but if you've got a business card, we'll save you having to.
There you go.
Thank you so much.